Do you think everybody understands metaphor? Is there anybody that doesn't understand metaphor?
I am so glad you asked that question. The answer is that every speaker of every language in the world uses metaphors effortlessly and with great frequency. That is how we make sense of the world. That is what our language is, and that is how the brain works.
So that's because that's the way we think, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the fundamental findings of cognitive science, is that we think in terms of frames and metaphors, which are structures physically present in our brains in the form of neural synapses. It's how we're wired, is to use metaphors to make sense of the world.
Well, I watched your TEDx talk in Paonia, the video of that, and in that you say the frame was kept, but the facts were ignored.
Exactly. That's the danger, right? Is if we're not paying attention to metaphors, if we're not aware of which metaphors are at work, if we've just received the metaphors and we're not conscious of them, then they're still influencing us even though we're not aware of them. It's really, if you think about it, that's how most of advertising works. I mean, there's a lot of people who know how this works, and those people can easily manipulate those of us who aren't being so conscious.
Wow. So there's a novel explanation for the rise of Donald Trump right there.
I don't know if we're going to tackle that one today.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. We'll stay safe. Yeah, well,
I can't explain that. I can't. That one is beyond me.
Yeah, well, I guess he just has different metaphors than you and me.
I think he does. Mm-hmm. There's a really great book, Luke, called Don't Think of an Elephant by George Lakoff, in which it's a very political book, and he goes into great detail about the right wing and the ways that they have used metaphor. They have, you know, kind of brilliant think tanks that have exploited language and metaphor to create legislation that is often the exact opposite of what it says it is, you know, like the Clean Air Act, for instance.
Yeah. Well, that's the essence of Big Brother. That was the whole message of 1984.
Right. Right.
And the first, right. One of the masters of that, manipulating metaphors, were the Nazis.
This is interesting, right? Because what we can do with metaphors is so powerful. And it's true on a global level or on a national level, and it's very true on an individual level, you know, for us to. This is why I think metaphors are so exciting, is because if we can identify these metaphors that are framing our thoughts and defining our actions, then we can change the way we see the world. We can change the way that we engage with the world. And that is thrilling. I think, you know, and here's a sweet example from, this isn't from my life, but a story that came from Carbondale. There was a boy there who was going to school at CRMS, Max, who one day was in the middle of the quad weeping. And the math teacher, Tim, comes along and says, "Max, why are you crying?" And Max says, "Gravity. I hate it so much." And Tim says, "Max, think of it like a giant hug, like the earth reaching up to embrace you." Which is, of course, exactly what gravity is. And Max was okay.
Wow. So that Tim, the teacher, changed the frame for Max.
He changed the frame. Gravity went from something that makes things drop, that tears things down, to something that's reaching up to embrace us.
Wow, that sounds like something Plato and Socrates might have talked about one day or something. That's amazing.
I have to say, I was so impressed with Tim to have that answer so immediately. Yeah.
Yes, very impressive. How about that?
Uh-huh.
Well, Rosemary, we're talking because you are getting set to do a poetry workshop, although I noticed from your website that you don't like to call them workshops. You call them play shops.
Yeah, because work sounds like work, right? And, you know, I guess as much as it's true, it could be work. We could call it work if people really want to. Uh-huh. But certainly part of the reason that I continue to write poems every day, you know, for many, many, many years, is because there's so much pleasure in it. And I think that's what I hope we'll explore together, is some pleasure of writing. Writing is such a solitary act, Luke. You know, one of my mentors, A.R. Ammon, says, you know, why would anybody want to be a poet and sit alone in a room all day picking away at your own liver? you know, it's a solitary act. We do. It's very reclusive. However, sometimes we get together. And when we get together, like in a class, like the one that we're going to be doing together on Saturday, or even the reading that we'll be doing that night, when we have this beautiful energy of all these beings, there's communion that happens. It's thrilling, it's exciting, and it's so much more than work. You know, I really think that playing with words is one of the things that brings people to poetry, is a love of language and what happens when we let the words do what words do and how they open us up then.
Well, the play shop is titled Rigorous Willingness, Writing from the Unconstricted Throat. So let's break that down. Tell me about what is rigorous willingness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what I think about when I think about writing, and when I think about people who aren't writing, why aren't we writing? What keeps us from writing? And for so many people, I think it's a sense of disappointment, perfectionism. They're not going to like what they're going to write. It's not going to be any good. Why even try if it's not going to be great? I think we put an awful lot of pressure on ourselves, and we make this very serious. And I think what's possible, beyond setting out to write something good, is to set out to write something. First of all, just to set out to write something. That's good enough, right? This is the first promise that I make myself every day. I will write something. Hmm. And the next promise I make myself is I will write something that it doesn't have to be good, but it does have to be true. And by that, I mean it has to be something authentic. I can't just be writing it to sound nice. It has to be something that has real resonance for me. And if within this parameter, this is what I call showing up, right, is the willingness to write something and to know that it doesn't have to be good. You just are going to write it because it's true. And I don't mean factual, by the way. Like, it doesn't have to be. It can be fictional, but it has to be authentic.
Right.
And that's, I think, what I'm talking about with this rigorous willingness, is this willingness to say, I will do it. I'll do it. I'm going to show up. And I'm not just going to show up today. I'm going to show up tomorrow, and I'm going to show up the next day. I'm going to keep showing up. I'm going to show up and show up and show up. This I think, is really what a practice is, right, is the willingness to continue showing up. And the practice isn't, of course, you know, we say practice makes perfect, which is garbage. We're never going to get it right. So I think we say practice makes life worth living, right? Practice, the way we practice is that we allow this poetry practice to show up in every part of our lives and make our entire life that much richer because we are paying attention to the world differently.
Well, how did you become rigorous in your practice? I know you've been writing a poem a day for many, many years. And was it just that, showing up every day?
That is really it. I think that it's quite that simple. But there's a little story behind it, Luke. So 11 years ago or so, my friend, maybe 12, my friend Jude Jeanette was leading a workshop in Salida. And I was in that workshop, quite a few of us. And Jude had just finished doing a poem a day for 30 days. And she put it out there to all of us that we could do it too. And I remember thinking, no way. Every day for 30 days. That just sounded impossible. But Jude's plan for us was this. Said, find two other people, because one person is going to flake out, so you need to have three, and make a promise to each other that you will send each other your poems every day. That creates a little bit of accountability, which I think is important, and come up with, you know, whatever your own rules are about if you respond or not or whatever. So I immediately thought, okay, I want to try. And I first asked my friend, Ellen, who was sitting next to me. I'm like, Ellen, let's do it. She said, yeah. And then I chose another woman sitting across the room who I didn't know, but I very much wanted to. She looked and sounded very interesting, and I approached her and said, would you like to try this poem a day thing with us for 30 days? She considered it very carefully and said, yes. So we did. It was an equinox, and we ended up writing our poems every day for 30 days, and we enjoyed it so much that we ended up doing it all the way to the solstice. So a 90-day stint. And then after that, they both stopped. Mm-hmm. But I never did. I just kept going. I thought, and here's what I can say about it, Luke, is that, and this really goes to that rigorous willingness piece. You know, I think sometimes people think, in fact, I had a student today say, I don't think I'm a writer, because writers are people who absolutely have to write. They just have to do it. And that would not describe me. I don't feel like I have to do it. Like, it's really easy for me to not write. Like, really easy. It'd be so simple to not write anymore. And that's why I have this practice in place, is because it invites me every day to show up. It requires me every day to show up and see what's available and see what's here today. It's different every day, every single day. A blank page every single day. I arrive, I have no idea what's going to happen. And every single day, something happens. It's amazing. It's like it's real magic. Something happens out of nothing. It's so exciting.
Do you do it at the same time every day? In the morning, in the evening?
Yeah, I recently changed. I've always been a night writer, like late night after the kids go to bed. And now I've shifted my schedule so that I wake up quite early in the morning and do my writing in the morning before making breakfast and get everybody out to school. I think it's quite different, too, by the way. I think that writing at night versus writing in the morning is a very different practice.
Oh, interesting.
Just in terms of, you know, at the end of the day, you're kind of full of the day, and it tends to be much more reflective writing. And in the morning, you've got the day in front of you, and it tends to be much more forward-looking. It's interesting how that time shift has shifted things in my writing.
So can you look at all those days of poems and know which ones you wrote in the morning and which ones you wrote in the evening? I don't know.
Here's the other thing, Luke, is that because I write so many poems, I write them and forget them. Like, almost instantly. They just kind of pass through.
Interesting. Now, some of those poems that you've written every day, have they made it into any of your published collections?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's interesting that you bring that up. You know, I think in some ways what I do with having my poems, I put them out every day. I put them out on a blog, and I have an email list. I send them out. So they go out to thousands of people every day. And what I think is kind of funny about that is that every day what I'm doing is putting my rough draft, my first draft, out into the world, which is probably foolish. But the other thing that I love about it is always fresh, right? It is always fresh. And then when I'm creating a collection, what I do is I take the ones that somehow stand out to me, and I'll often just, you know, I'll scroll through and look at 100, 200, 300 poems and notice which ones jump out, and I'll pull those, you know, together, and then there's a lot of revising that happens with those poems before they would go into a publication.
Sure.
So I believe very much in craft. I guess it's a very separate process than the generative process.
I noticed that most of your play shops are not so much concerned with craft. They're more concerned with process. Is that a fair statement?
Lately, that's probably true. Yeah. You know, I guess I've done a lot of workshops that are on lately on themes like uncertainty or play or willingness or, I mean, those are themes that are always failure. Those are themes that are very interesting to me. I also do themes, you know, like motherhood, where I'm doing, or grief, where I'm doing them for specific groups. So that they, I guess what I like is for them to feel open to anyone, so that anyone who thought they would want to come, whether they had a lot of experience or no experience at all, could think, oh, well, there will be a place for me here. And now and then I like to do more focused things, for instance, how to write really good last lines, or how to, you know, how to play with meter, or how to play with rhyming, you know, slant rhymes. So I guess you're right. I think these days, mostly I want to.
Uh-huh. That makes sense.
Play with the larger themes.
Well, the second part of the play shop title, Writing from the Unconstricted Throat. The first thing I think of when I read that is, how do you make yourself unfettered? How do you release the things that keep you from doing what you want to do as far as writing goes? Is that what you're getting at, or is there something else involved?
Well, I think part of what happens, and this goes back to that good versus true, right? And when we want something to be good, we choke. I mean, that's...
Literally.
I'm sure. Literally. You know, you sit there with your white page and it stays white. You try and speak and nothing comes out because you're afraid it's not going to be good. So how do we open that up? How do we allow this throat, this metaphor for our voice? How do we open up our voice? And I guess I really believe we do it through play. It's just like children, right? The best way to teach children is to play with them, and they learn so naturally this way. You know, instead of doing flashcards, you know, make cookies together. You know, I mean, I guess there's just lots of ways that you can bring information in an engaging, fun way. And so that's, I guess, going back to the play shop idea too. We'll be doing some games, you know, that will open people up and allow them to be silly, so that we can lower our expectations. I guess I think that's one of the most important steps of writing, at least in the beginning, right? You can always have your standard back later. But to start, we need to just open that up. And the way we do that is through play, through allowing ourselves to be open to whatever happens.
Huh. It sounds like it's a process of becoming unselfconscious, or put another way, kind of getting out of your own way.
Getting out of your own way. You could not have said that better. That's exactly it. I mean, we really are our biggest problem. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Yeah, I like to say that the poem knows more than you do. I believe this so much. And sometimes we come to the page with an agenda. I'm going to write about this. It's going to look like this. And this is this completely cuts off everything that's possible to happen in that poem. My friend Catherine Bass, this is so my third rule. So far I'm giving you all my rules for myself. The first rule is that I will write. The second rule is that it doesn't have to be good, but it has to be true. The third rule is that I can't know the ending. And I think often that's having an agenda, right? And that's thinking that we know more than the poem. And when we do that, we cut ourselves off from all possibilities of what could happen, what the poem might have had to teach us if we'd stayed open to it. And my friend Catherine calls this, if you know the ending, it's like having an emergency exit, and you just jump out of the poem before it has taught you what it has to teach you.
Oh, huh. That's interesting. That's really interesting. Wow. I wonder, Rosemary, before I let you go here, I wonder if you'd read us a poem.
Mm-hmm. I will. This is one I wrote about failure. It started when a friend of mine, Phyllis, sent me a New York Times headline, and that will be in the title. Here, it's a fairly long title. After my friend Phyllis sends me the New York Times headline, Lou Michaels, all-purpose player, dies at 80, missed kicks in 69 Super Bowl. So I read this headline, right, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's awful. They put his
he's
his
remembered for the
in
worst
the
moment. Of...
So I'm like, that's terrible. Uh-huh. And so this is the poem that I wrote after that.
Okay.
When I die, let them write about all the mistakes I've made. Let them say in the headlines how many rejection letters I've received from the Sun magazine. Let them say, Mr. Calling for Broadway back in 1987. Let them say, she tried hard, but she never did win a Nordic skate race. They can note how my children always fought in front of company. How the beets in my garden never grew bigger than golf balls. How every chocolate cake I ever made sank in the center. And how I never even watched the Super Bowl, much less knew who was playing for the Colts back in 1969 when Lou Michaels mixed two field goals that helped the Jets win. What do any of us really accomplish? My friend Wayne says we do what we can and have mercy. Yes. Let them say I did what I could. Let them say that I loved the best that I knew how and messed that up too. It's what we do, we who are kicking our way to the back pages of the paper. Fallible and well-intentioned, faithful and confused as we are, we mess up. So yes, mercy on us. Mercy on all our failing little hearts, how they beat so sincerely. Mercy on this longing to shine, to be brilliant, and all these reminders again and again and again to kneel.
To kneel.
Mm.
Ooh. Wow, that was a little bit of an unexpected ending. That's beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I am fascinated, Luke, by failure, and noticed that I write quite a few poems about it.
Wow, how about that? I love that synchronicity. That's Lou Graham right there.
Isn't that awesome for the car alarm next to me to go off right
now? I love it. That is really that's really great. You know what?
That's the world for you.
I am not going to edit that out of this. Oh, that is too good. That is great.
Oh, the world just shows up, doesn't it?
that is an appropriate way to end this. That's really cool. Thanks, Rosemary. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Luke.
Okay.
A pleasure. Thank you for talking today.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye.